Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 25th of March. All things political coming up this hour. As a matter of fact, you hear all things political each Monday from 9 until 10. Mark Sandolo is our guest. He is Associate Academic Director at the University of California's Washington Center, where he teaches journalism and politics, and also is the editor of the California News Service. Mark has been a journalist for nearly three decades, including 21 years at the San Francisco Chronicle, where he served as the paper's Washington Bureau Chief. He is author of Madam Speaker, The Life, Times, and Rise of Nancy Pelosi, as well as two books on baseball stadiums. Eventually, there will be baseball, not too far around the corner, just about a week. We are going to welcome phone calls from Mark. We have a lot to talk about this hour. A couple things that are front and center. Certainly the Supreme Court hearing two arguments on gay marriage this week. Those will take place on Tuesday and Wednesday. And I know Mark has written about this. Today, the mayor of New York is beginning a $12 million national ad campaign focusing on senators in certain states he thinks might be persuaded to support federal regulations to curb gun violence. We'll talk about what is likely to be passed, what is likely to not be passed, and why that is the case. The president returned from Israel. We'll talk about the significance of that journey. And so those are a few of the things that are on the table. Join us, 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And just a sneak preview of next hour, Dr. Jane Goodall will be with us for a good chunk of next hour, which we're very excited about. And we're excited about Mark as well. Hello, Mark. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Yeah, you mentioned baseball. I don't know what you've got out there in Wisconsin, but here in D.C., we're talking cherry blossoms this time of year. We've got about an inch of snow on the ground.
Do you in Washington?
Like a ways away. In Washington, which my kids are furious because it's spring break here, an inch of snow, canceling of schools. They're bitter. Snow day. We just don't do. I grew up in the Midwest, so I and a lot of people in Washington laugh at this, but when it snows, Washington shuts down.
Right. Oh my goodness, I didn't know you had that kind of weather. Well, it's just 31, and it's just last year all the flowers were out. It's just hard to take, but we have to take it, right?
And with global warming, it'll get earlier every year.
Yeah. Eventually, it will. Well, thank you very much for being with us. And let's start with guns, if you don't mind. I know you've written about this, and I'm wondering where Michael Bloomberg is putting his $12 million in a national advertising campaign. A couple questions. Why is this issue so huge with this mayor? $12 million is no small chunk of change.
There was a remarkable bit of analysis in the Washington Post over the weekend where they took a look at handgun deaths and they broke it down by race. And essentially, if you are an African American, per capita, the population, your chances of being murdered by a handgun are something like 20 times that of white America. Whereas in white America, your chances of using a gun to commit suicide are about 10 times stronger than they are if you're an African-American. There's an enormous divide, not only between, race in America, but between urban and rural. And, this in Wisconsin, the attitudes towards guns in, downtown Milwaukee or Madison compared to upstate are dramatically different because people use them for different reasons. So in New York City, Mayor Bloomberg represents a place where handguns are used almost exclusively to hurt other people. There's a whole lot of hunting that goes on in New York City. And he's done this before. He's done this with public health campaigns, too. He's done this with political campaigns. He's done this with education, taking a huge amount of his money, and he's worth over $1 billion, and put it towards it. His frustration, in his view, the only reason that the United States doesn't pass more moderate gun control laws than they've passed in the past before is simply because of the political clout of the National Rifle Association and the money that they give in political campaigns. So his thought is to serve as a counterweight to that, And if he can put millions of dollars into campaigns in places to make it uncomfortable to vote against gun control, he thinks he can win. And when you look at some of the Democratic senators who are up for re-election this year, this is where he's putting the money. You've got people in states like Arkansas and Alaska and Louisiana and Montana. These are Democratic senators from these states that are facing tough re-election campaigns. If they don't have some sort of support of, you know, gun owners, they can't win re-election.
He put a lot of money into Illinois in a congressional race, and the candidate who was really anti-NRA wound up winning that race. Do you think that he might be successful in some of these other campaigns in some of the states you just mentioned?
Money works. I mean, you know, clearly we've seen enough to know that money isn't all decisive. It's not as if you can simply buy an election, but yet constant ads make a big, big difference. And also, you know, think if you're somebody like a Mark Begich from Alaska, and you're trying to decide what to do on this gun vote coming up. Now, this is not a big, we're not talking about outlawing guns in America. We're not even talking about an assault weapon ban.
Right.
What we're talking about with Bloomberg is simply making it so that wherever you buy a gun, whether it's from a store where you have to do a background check now, or at a gun show, you'd have to go through some sort of background check. So it's tightening up this gun background check business. If you're Mark Begich and you're trying to figure out how to vote on the Senate floor, and you understand that voting in favor of this new regulation means that you will have millions of dollars in contributions from the National Rifle Association thrown against you and towards your opponent, and you think to yourself, I actually favor this law, but if I do this, I don't get reelected for 6 years, and suddenly you've got the mayor of New York City saying, by the way, you've got millions of dollars coming behind you if you do vote for this law, it, of course, can make a difference.
Right. So where do we stand on this issue right now? Does it look likely that we will get passage of universal background checks, but not much more than that?
At the most, Kathleen, I mean, it's remarkable because when you look at the emotion that came out of the last massacre in
Yes.
Connecticut with all those children, there was a cry, you know, big hue and cry that this had to end. And that emotion has persisted to a certain degree. I think the last poll I saw that pretty strong majority of Americans still support an assault weapon ban. Something like 90% support these universal background checks. But the clout on the anti-gun control side, the pro-gun side, is so strong right now that at this point, the assault weapon ban is not even going to be brought up for a vote. The universal background checks is probably going to be voted on, and it's going to be a very, very close vote. Instead, what we're likely to see are things like stepped-up enforcement of existing laws, maybe some money going to school safety. There's going to be something that all senators and members of the House are going to be able to say, gun control, we passed gun control. But no matter what passes, it's really not going to be a very big change in the existing law.
Mm. Well, after Newtown, indications were that the NRA wasn't really very, very well organized on this issue, and they didn't have support, and they didn't know how to take on the issue. Did they get their act together?
They are such a insular organization. It's so difficult to know what goes on. As a member of the media, when you make a phone call to them, you know, you get a spokesman and that's it. You're not going to get some off-the-record conversation with any of the policymakers or lobbyists. So it's very hard to know what's going on. The one thing the National Rifle Association has always had going for it is the slippery slope argument. The idea that, you know, yeah, of course you don't need an AK-47 to go out and hunt deer. At the same time, you know, that's only one step away. First they want your AK-47, then they're going to want you to start registering. Next thing you know, they're going to confiscate all your guns and we have a fascist state.
Right.
And that was their logic. And there was the other side was the other extreme. It was the liberal urban folks who said, yeah, we've got to take away handguns. They're killing people. And if you enjoy going out and hunting furry animals on the weekend, tough luck. You got to stop that because we're killing each other with these. And there was no middle ground. What's happened to a certain extent, and Bloomberg very wisely has put his money behind this, the ads that Bloomberg is running, they don't say things like, you know, guns kill people, it's time to stop. They have hunters out there saying, I will defend my constitutional right. My Second Amendment right to own a gun is paramount. That doesn't mean that I want crazy people being able to buy guns. And when I buy a gun and when you buy a gun, you need a background check. So it's that middle ground that has caught fire a little bit. I'm always surprised that there has not been an alternative to the NRA, sort of an NRA light, a group which is dedicated to defending the Second Amendment, but that doesn't believe that bazookas ought to be legal or otherwise they're going to take guns away. And we started to see some of that middle ground emerge. This round, it doesn't look as if much is going to change, but I'd be shocked if in 10 years we don't have, you know, somewhat more tight regulations on firearms.
10 years, though. That's a long time.
10 years is a long time, and sadly, we're talking about tens of thousands of handgun and rifle deaths between now and then.
The other big story, certainly, of this week are the gay marriage cases that will be argued before the Supreme Court. I asked in the intro to this show, is there an aura of inevitability over gay marriage? Is there?
I think so. When you start seeing people like, you know, Dick Cheney has long been a conservative who was good with gay marriage. This week we saw Rob Portman, the senator from Ohio, who was very close to being John McCain's running mate, him saying that he supports gay marriage. It may not seem remarkable, but Hillary Clinton went out of her way to make clear that she supports gay marriage. When you think back just a few years ago, you made me feel very old in that introduction. I have been doing this a while. I was actually covering City Hall in San Francisco when Mayor Dianne Feinstein back in the 80s vetoed a domestic partners resolution, which would have simply given benefits to same-sex couples who registered with the city, who worked for the city, the same benefits that married couples got.
Oh, my.
Now, almost every private company in the country right now offers that. Almost every municipality and state offers some version of that. Dianne Feinstein, who a few years ago said marriage is between a man and a woman, she's now officiated gay marriages. You know, people on her staff have gotten married, and she's been, this has been just a sea change in attitudes with President Obama. And I think back to some of the political campaigns I covered as somebody who wrote for many years for the San Francisco Chronicle. I always thought this was a good issue to push. And I remember being in a car, an interview with a car ride with Dick Gephardt in 2000, Democratic running for president. And he was in favor of equal rights. And I said, yeah, but why aren't you in favor of marriage? And he says to me, because marriage is between a man and a woman. And I said, I understand you believe that, but could you explain that? Just elaborate on that. Marriage is between a man and a woman. Five times he says this to me. Clearly, the message was, you're a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle. If you think I'm going to stray from my message on this dangerous issue, forget it. 4 years later, I remember talking to Howard Dean, who was a hero among a lot of gay activists because he had signed domestic partnership legislation in Vermont. Howard Dean was against marriage, same sex, and I pushed him on that. Didn't take Dean more than about a minute, and I really am a nice guy. It took him about a minute to slam the phone down on me because he didn't want to go there. Now the idea that you have a potential candidate for president on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, who wasn't asked casually, she produced a videotape
and sent
it over to the Human Rights Campaign, the big gay lobbying group, to say I support gay marriage, because to run for president in the Democratic Party in 2016 means being out there and in favor on this issue. It is definitely an issue that is inevitable.
So what in the world happened, Mark, to change public opinion relatively rapidly?
That's an excellent question, and I don't know I can give more than, you know, pop psychology to this. I do teach college students these days, and it's remarkable the difference. I ask them all sorts of political questions, and although they tend to be liberal, these are University of California college students, so it's what you'd expect. But there always are a few holdouts on, there are always some Republicans in the class. There are always some people who are pro-life in the class. There are people who are economic conservatives. Virtually none, and I mean virtually none, we're talking about maybe one student a year who is willing to venture that for some sort of religious reason they don't think that same-sex marriages ought to be legal. Young people are just overwhelmingly accepting of it. And this is where the pop psychology comes in. It's very cliched, but, you know, you saw it seep into the media, you know, a decade or two ago with shows like Will and Grace and, you know, now Modern Family. It is all over the media now that to be a same-sex couple, to be a homosexual of any kind, is just a normal thing. It doesn't define you as a human being. And I think a generation ago when I was growing up, that was a very different attitude. And with the civil rights movements with blacks and whites as part of history now, I think an awful lot of young people just feel this is just a basic right. And you have an awful lot of old people now who either have come along to that, in Rob Portman's case, the senator from Ohio, because his son came out to him as gay, and he did not want to deprive his son of the opportunities anyone else would get. And then there's this, you know, harsh, cold political reality, as some Republicans have warned, you know, their colleagues, if we are going to be the party that opposes gays, then this generation that is growing up is never going to vote for us, and we're not going to win elections, and we've got to change.
Mark Sandolo is our guest for All Things Political, and we come to the part of the show where we welcome your phone calls. We've talked about two issues. What are we likely to see in terms of gun safety laws and also the Supreme Court taking up gay marriage arguments this week? There are a lot of other issues as well. We do want to talk a little bit about the president's trip to Israel and to Jordan, the remarkable speech that he gave, and what was accomplished, and whatever other issues you would like to explore. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. All ways you can reach us. To you in a moment, you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, Dr. Jane Goodall, primatologist and conservationist, will be joining us to talk about the importance of sustaining natural and cultural diversity. She has done so much extraordinary work since the 1960s. Paul Robbins will also join us, director of the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies at UW-Madison. Dr. Goodall will be in Madison to talk about the conference that they are having coming up in April. All right, to your phone calls for Mark Sandolo, Associate Academic Director, University of California's Washington Center. He also is former Washington Bureau Chief for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's author of Madam Speaker, The Life, Times, and Rise of Nancy Pelosi. David in Madison, hi.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you to your guests. And I would just like to comment and then a very quick question. The two main items of which you've spoken the last few minutes are very interesting, and they fall into the general category of sometimes falling by the wayside of getting something done because of hyper-partisanship and the like. So that underlying theme is what I'd like the guests to comment upon in this context. Perhaps a pathway to, you know, break loose of gridlock. I know many have tried and no one has succeeded yet, but in 1961, the United States Supreme Court, in a case Baker v. Carr, said that state legislative redistricting was not a political question and the federal government could become involved. The first item is, if the redistricting could be addressed not state by state, you know, where hopefully in Wisconsin I know some major publications push for a nonpartisan redistricting, but through the federal courts in the way that the Tennessee case Baker v. Carr in 61 got rid of the old frozen districts that favored the rural districts at that time. So there would be some kind of a judicial initiative, judicial group, a lawsuit to test whether or not redistricting, and it would fall equally upon Republicans and Democrats who egregiously game the system when they're in control. That might create a situation where we might have a chance for state legislatures and congressional districts that would actually represent, for example, in the background check, the 90% to 10%. At least it would be more possible rather than having gerrymandered districts like we have now in the country. So what about the chance of the judicial option there? And secondly, having served in local government myself, and many people do and have, usually at the local level in most states and most municipalities, school boards and the like, there is a very strict laws about not having meetings that aren't open to the public when a majority of the elected officials are involved, school board members, city council. And here what we have at the state and the federal level, is my last comment, is the fact that the majority caucus meets behind closed doors. They whip into shape and, you know, and paddle those who aren't going to adopt the party line. If there could be legislative efforts to, in the Wisconsin tradition perhaps, to make those party caucuses where a majority of elected officials are meeting and discussing the policy and the laws that are going to be brought forward. If those would be open, suddenly, instead of the leaders emerging from behind closed doors in Madison or Washington, D.C., we could actually see what happened. Because right now, all we have is they come out with a party line they've already decided, and all the votes on one side are in favor, and all the other side are opposed. Those are two possible pathways to out of the gridlock for a more representative democracy. So if your guests could comment,
okay,
please.
Thanks, David. Mark.
David hits on really great points here about redistricting, because the partisanship is a real problem. Washington is bitterly divided. There is very little evidence that the nation is bitterly divided. You know, I think the media plays a role in pushing the divide, because divide is always a better story than not divide. Black and white is easier to write about than gray. And so how do you fix that problem? And David, it's a real wise point on the redistricting. So a couple thoughts on that. I mean, first of all, in California, they've done this. This was part of a reform that Governor Schwarzenegger pushed through and was approved by the voters, and they took out of the hands of the state legislatures the drawing of California's 53 congressional districts and put in the hands of an independent board. And there was lots of screaming and yelling about how it wasn't really fair and about how certain groups got left out, and there will always be that. But one thing that was changed was you did not have the controlling party in the state legislature, in this case in Sacramento, deciding how to divide up the districts. The result was California has 14 new members of Congress. Some like six incumbents lost. You had eight people who were, or six or seven people who decided not to run for reelection. And California has a few more moderates than they might have had otherwise. They're not as partisan. Now, for California to do this unilaterally, this California News Service, I run with some students, research this, California lost about 300 years of seniority combined. That, in a system where it's based on seniority, doesn't do all that well for the state. Now, David makes a good point. You could do this federally so that no one state does it to themselves. And, I mean, you know, talking to people in Wisconsin, any state that can send, you know, Tammy Baldwin and Paul Ryan to Washington from the same place knows something about extremes.
Exactly.
I'm sorry.
No, you're right. I was just commenting.
Oh, okay, good. I was hoping I didn't. And I know that who is the new representative from Madison?
Well, Ron Johnson is our state senator, and Tammy Baldwin.
Okay. When you look at the districts, and I don't have my Wisconsin down, you know, clear enough to tell you exactly, but I know that when you look at, you know, Ryan's district, which is what sort of a square squat box in the bottom southeastern corner of the state, and then you have, you know, representatives from Madison, you don't have to draw the districts that way. It's easy for the politicians to say, you know what, Let's not bother to spend all this money. Let's just, we have a safe Republican district, and you get conservatives like Ryan elected. Let's just have a liberal district, and you put Madison on a group. You don't have to divide the lines that way. You could divide them, you know, horizontally, rectangular. You could do it in all sorts of different ways, so that instead of having a safe conservative and liberal seats, you would have two moderate seats, and that would certainly change the onus on compromise. The problem is the Constitution does say that this is up to the states, and with one glaring exception, the Supreme Court and the federal government has been loath to get involved in ordering states how to do that. That big exception, of course, was 2000 in Gore v. Bush, when the Florida Supreme Court said, this is our verdict, and we're going to do a recount, and the federal government stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. So there is some precedent for stepping in and making some changes. You could, of course, have a constitutional amendment that changes this. When you think, and you know, the most egregious example was back 2000 in Florida, when the woman who oversaw the election process was a elected Republican official, Kathleen Harris, and a friend of the Bush family. Why, and most states have their secretaries of state or the registrar of voters, is a partisan office. That seems crazy in a country where we are competing between two different parties. The one solution I've seen suggested, which makes you realize how messed up our system is, because this isn't going to happen, is to go to an Australian rules voting. In Australia, you got to vote. If you don't vote, something like a $500 fine. So they get something like 99.9% turnout. If you did that, what it would mean is both parties would understand that their base is going to show up. The old model in politics was 40% will vote Democrat, 40% will vote Republican. You're always fighting for that 20% in the middle. That's not true anymore. What parties are doing is saying, if we get our 40% to show up en masse, then we're going to win this election. So you have both sides appealing to their bases. If you knew for sure that your base was going to turn up, or otherwise they're going to pay a $500 fine, then politicians like Barack Obama wouldn't need to fire up the left to make sure they show up. And Mitt Romney wouldn't have to, you know, run to the right on issues like immigration, fearful he won't get conservative votes. Instead, you'd have them competing to the middle, and it could be a big change. But that seems very far-fetched. That's going to happen in the United States. You know, down the road, could what David's talking about happen? Sure, I suppose it's possible there could be federal changes. The problem is this. The people in charge of making those changes are the city lawmakers. They have a vested interest in the status quo. That's what got them there.
Yeah. Mark Pocan is the guy we were thinking of from took Tammy's seat. I believe that's correct. Let's go to Madison and Pat. Hello, Pat.
Hi. Good morning to you both. So my comment or question relates to gun violence. And, you know, clearly it's a complex issue and, you know, very passionate voices on all sides of it. So what I hear from the, you know, those who do not favor gun control, further gun control or gun control, is that it's a mental health, more of a mental health issue being needed to address, needing to be addressed. And, you know, knowing that the wait lists for mental health services are long, usually for, you know, throughout the state, is it feasible, is it reasonable that there could be some traction for a notion of, you know, taking a percentage of gun sales and funneling that into mental health services to kind of stem some of that pressure on the few services that are out there now and the long waiting list?
It makes sense, Pat. It is not going to happen. And the reason I shouldn't say it's not going to happen, it seems unlikely. Let me tell you what, as you put it, sounds like a reasonable proposal would get translated to by those who support guns and the gun rights. You're proposing a tax on gun owners. That's the way they would put it. If you're going to start to say that some of the proceeds from gun sales are going to go to these kind of programs, that means the government is going to be confiscating some of that money from gun sales. That money is going to be passed on to, you know, to the people who buy the guns, and people are going to describe that as now we are taxing good and decent hunters who go up and they hunt game on the weekends. We're going to tax them because a few crazies in the cities are going off killing each other, and that's simply not fair. That's the way that this argument has been, you know, pitted against each other. I do think you bring a good point that there is a lot of talk that, you know, guns, you know, guns kill people, crazy people kill each other. And to deal with guns is only one part of the equation. You got to deal with the crazy people as well. This gets increasingly difficult in the time when government's trying to spend less money and not more. But, I mean, I do think that this sort of all-of-the-above approach, which is what Obama talks about when he talks about energy, but it works for guns too. You know, you do a little bit of this, you do a little bit of that, you do background checks. Maybe you minimize the number of rounds that are in a clip. You get help for people who need help. You have gun training. There are all sorts of things you can do. None of them are going to solve the problem, but it doesn't mean that you don't take each step in hopes it does a little something.
You're listening to All Things Political on the Ideas Network. We have a couple lines open right now if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. You can always send an email as well, and that's talk@wpr.org. Phyllis in Milwaukee, hi.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. It's just pretty straightforward comment today. I really appreciate you bringing up the point about, you know, if we appeal to our 40%, we've covered our bases and we can move forward and win an election. My comment stems from the fact that straight out of college, I worked for a number of representatives for the Republican Party, and now I'm approaching 40, and I feel kind of like man without a country. I don't feel like I have a home. I don't feel like they've continued to grow with me as a person. You made the comment about when you're teaching in the universities today, there's, of course, a lot of liberal people. I, as a college student, found my home in the Republican Party, and now I don't have anywhere to land. I think that that's also why there's a lot of people who are starting to kind of hit the fringes in terms of the development of the Tea Party, which, in my opinion, and if you would be so kind as to comment, the bipartisanship has always been effective in a sense, but it works. And now when we start to branch out into all these additional parties, I think that what people aren't going to be seeing is effective government in terms of how easily we are able to make decisions, pass laws. It's just because the water gets more murky. Could you please comment on the addition of some of these parties that are starting to come to fruition, as well as is there any attention being paid not just to the youth and not just to the Republicans who have been there for, or Democrats both, you know, the classic sense of what those parties are, but kind of these people who are struggling to find their home again, i.e., I was raised when growing up, you know, the older you got, the more money you got, you tended to go Republican. Now we're in that position, and we're not voting that way anymore.
Mark.
Things do change, and, you know, the frustration that, Phyllis, you talk about is obviously true with a lot of Republicans, and one of the reasons this happens, I mean, things change in American politics in these big shifts. You know, it used to be that the South was solidly Democratic, and they were very conservative. You had segregationists, you had bigots, you had racists who were Democrats from the South, and after the civil rights legislation passed, they, as President Johnson had predicted in the 60s, abandoned the Democratic Party. They started to join the Republican Party. The Republican Party was not a party of bigots and racists, but by any means. But what happened is, as these people abandoned the Democrats, there was, among other things, a strong Southern conservative religious push, which found a home then in the Republican Party, and Republicans embraced them because Republicans, of course, needed every vote they could get. And George Bush in 2000 was very explicit about this. This was a guy who he was a born-again Christian, but he didn't wear his religion on his sleeve in the sense that he didn't govern from a religious standpoint. But he understood in 2000 that if he could marry the religious conservatives to the economic conservatives and, you know, the foreign policy before 2001, I'm not even sure he had a strong view on, but that he could win that, you know, 50%. And he didn't win 50%. He lost the vote, but he barely won the presidency. And there are an awful lot of people, like Phyllis, who have been natural Republicans because of their economic conservative views, who have been appalled by some of the religious conservative views. And it's a real problem for the Republican Party right now. But these things do change. I'm not sure a third party is likely to emerge simply because you have such structural advantages right now for the big parties in terms of fundraising. I mean, we're not talking just about in Washington, but, you know, all 50 states have operations set up. It would take, you know, somebody like a Bloomberg in New York, who has talked about it with his billions of dollars, to try to set something up. But, you know, we've seen this recently. Ross Perot did this a generation ago. It didn't go very far. But the parties do respond. And this is a democracy. You can say, oh, it's all politics. But they do respond to what the people want. So when Republicans start losing elections because people like Phyllis abandon them, they're going to do what they can to get Phyllis back. And if that means not catering to the religious right as much, well, that's something they may be willing to do. And some people see a mirror image. Some people see this is exactly what happened with Bill Clinton in 1992, that the Democratic Party had been so stuck in its liberal union ways that Bill Clinton, to the great frustration of an awful lot of liberals, stood up and said, you know what, unions aren't necessarily all good, and balanced budgets can be a good thing. We ought to make people work to get on welfare. A lot of liberals were furious. People quit his administration when he was president when he said things like that. But what he tried to do was grab a piece of the middle, and Republicans may do the same. I'm fascinated right now by Chris Christie in New Jersey, who is a conservative, but he has refused to sort of go along with the Republican dogma. I mean, he palled around with President Obama during those last couple days before the election because he needed federal aid for his state, which has been hit by the hurricane. He's been shunned by the Republican Party ever since, but that's going to make him real attractive to an awful lot of people, again, like Phyllis, who are, you know, who want a Republican who can say, you know, I'm not part of a dogma, and I don't necessarily believe that we ought to have government making decisions about what people do in the bedroom. And I think there's a big wave for that. So third party, probably not, but big changes coming up, you know, over a generation, I think it's inevitable.
Well, the Republicans have lost the White House twice now. You would think that there would be a great deal of soul searching going on to find out who their new voters. They have to get more people to vote for them, quite simply. So what new ideas are you hearing from the Republican Party to attract more people to vote for them?
The problem, and it's always easier to understand this if you are not a Republican, if you are a liberal, and I've spent years writing for the San Francisco Chronicle, so thinking of it from a Bay Area, which is a very liberal area's point of view, you know, when Republicans were winning the presidency, when Ronald Reagan was winning, and then George Bush, you know, Papa Bush won, most people in San Francisco didn't say, you know what, maybe we ought to cut down on welfare payments. Maybe the New Deal went too far. No, they said, we've got to redouble our efforts. It's because the country is in a bad place right now. We're going to try to rebrand our message, and we're going to stick to our policies. We're going to double down on our liberalism. Now, that didn't work nationally. Bill Clinton emerged instead. But there are an awful lot of Republicans, and we saw this convention of conservatives last week in Washington, the CPAC convention, where an awful lot of them said, there's nothing wrong with our principles. It's only a matter of how we sell them. So you've got one brand out there that says, let's just double down on everything we've said, and if we stand firm, we're going to win. But you also heard whispers of other people now who are saying there's no reason the Republican Party shouldn't be the party of gay marriage, that if you're a good, strong libertarian and believe that government should not be making decisions for everybody, then government shouldn't be making decisions about whether or not, you know, you have the right to marry somebody of the same sex. Maybe government shouldn't be involved in keeping out a new class of strong-minded workers who come across the border from Mexico. You know, maybe we can foster small business. You do hear these voices in the Republican Party of people who say these changes, immigration, gay marriage, even abortion, and even some on the social safety net saying, you know, we don't want to decimate Medicare and Medicaid. And these are popular political views, too. So you hear those voices, but right now those are sort of like the conservatives in the Democratic Party in the 1980s, who a lot of the left did not want to listen to. So we'll see which side prevails in 2016.
We'll see. Mark Sandelow is our guest for All Things Political, Associate Academic Director, University of California's Washington Center. He teaches journalism and politics and serves as editor of the California News Service. He's former Washington Bureau Chief for the San Francisco Chronicle. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. The president returned from a trip to Israel and Jordan. We want to talk a little bit about that, some of what he said and some of what his goals are for that region. And we'll talk about other issues as well. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, there's going to be a major event at the Nelson Institute, Earth Day. It's a conference, and the keynote speaker is Dr. Jane Goodall, world-renowned primatologist, conservationist. She will be with us for a good chunk of the second hour of the program, as will Paul Robbins, who directs the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. So that's coming up, hour two of our show. Mark Sandelow, this hour, Associate Academic Director, University of California's Washington Center, and he is editor of the California News Service. Before before we go back to phone calls, the president returned from a very big trip to Israel and Jordan. I found the speech that he gave in Israel to that large collection of, it appeared like, mostly young people, was another one of his remarkable speeches, talking about the Palestinian state and resulting in quite a few cheers from the people who were gathered. What were the highlights of the trip? Was anything accomplished in this part of the world where peace is talked about and just doesn't happen?
Sadly, it doesn't look like there were any big fundamental changes. And, of course, we don't know what was said behind closed doors. Hopefully things of importance. Clearly, the president was able to reassure the Israelis that for all the political talk here about him, you know, abandoning Israel, that was not the case. And he made very clear publicly, and they say privately, that the U.S. stands with Israel, you know, shoulder to shoulder, and that Israel doesn't have to worry about security because the United States will protect it. But then he also raised these other issues, and this is where he's gotten beat up by some pro-Israel people in the States, because this president, more than other presidents, has been more willing to address some of the human rights grievances of the Palestinians and to at least acknowledge that until the Palestinians feel that they are equal partners, there is not going to be a lasting peace. But this is where the problem is. It's very hard to then reconcile all this. He had an interesting line when he was in Ramallah talking to Palestinians. He said that he can't help it when he meets young people, young Palestinians, thinking his own daughters, Malia and Sasha, and to think about how just a generation ago or a couple generations ago, they would not have had opportunities that they have today. And what he means is that as African Americans, this was a racist, segregated country that simply didn't allow them the same sort of opportunities, but change does happen. Well, it's a fascinating thought, but if you carry out that thinking, if the president is suggesting that Palestinians, in a sense, are treated the way that African Americans were in the United States in, say, the 1950s, he's suggesting then that Israel is an oppressor. He is suggesting that Israel has laws or practices that are that keep people down. Well, if that were the case, he is also being wined and dined and, you know, arm in arm and meeting with those oppressors. Clearly, he does not feel that you wouldn't stand with Lester Maddox and George Wallace and all the bigots from the 1950s if you saw them as oppressors. So there's a hypocrisy here, which certainly is not unique to President Obama. In fact, it's the United States policy towards Israel in a lot of ways that, you know, more and more there is sympathy for the Palestinian right to basic human rights. At the same time, the United States wants to make it absolutely clear that it's not going to abandon its one closest democratic ally in the Middle East. So into that confusion, yeah, the president went. He came back, I think, reassuring the Israelis. If I were a Palestinian, I think I'd be a little bit frustrated that they got some lip service, but not much else. And sadly, you know, my entire life I've watched presidents go to the Middle East, make it a priority.
Yes.
And, you know, once President Clinton even got, you know, Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat to shake hands on the White House lawn, but that certainly didn't seal any kind of peace.
What about Iran? How did he address Iran? And what does he mean, and everybody seems to mean, when they say, well, all options are on the table here?
Well, what they mean, and you know, they can be blunt where they cannot be blunt where people who talk on radio can. What he means is we don't want to take away the idea that we could drop a nuclear bomb on them, that we could invade them, that we could do anything. But in reality, we're not going to do any of those things. But to say we're not going to do that would be stupid, because then they can, you know, stick it in our eye. Mm-hmm. So I think what he's saying is that military force, if Iran continues to push nuclear weapons, then the possibility that we do to Iran what we did to Iraq, which is go out and take out the government, is something that he refuses to take off the table. That said, there is nothing in Barack Obama's past that makes you think anything like that is possible or likely. He's pushing for, you know, economic sanctions, and it's a very scary thought when you think, I mean, right now it's diplomacy, but if Iran suddenly had a weapon, or if, say, North Korea actually had weapons that could reach, you know, San Francisco, suddenly that changes things, because then you have to really wonder whether the president would order military operations. And thankfully, we're not at that position yet.
Dave in Menominee, hi.
Hi. Hi, good morning. I wanted to talk about the post office.
All right.
All the cuts that are happening. You know, in all the reports that I hear and what I read, nobody ever brings up why this is happening. In 2006, during the lame duck session, after the Republicans were voted out of the Senate and House, before January 20th, they forced through a law under Tom DeLay that required the post office to fund their health care and retirement for 75 years. And they had to fund that 75 years in a 10-year window, which makes it impossible. No business could ever, ever do that. They also restrict the post office from any other services, providing any other services. And the post office is 80% of the problem of their lack of funds there is because of this law. And the post office knows they can raise another 20% by selling other things at the post office. So the solution here is we're seeing them make cuts instead of changing this law. And I wanted to get your guest comments on that.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, I don't pretend to be, you know, an expert, except I go to my mailbox 6 days a week and, you know, and have always taken for granted that this is a government service that I get. I mean, on the one hand, the world has changed. You don't need to get depending on where you live. If you live in a big city like I do, you do not need daily mail service because 99% of what I get is junk, and if it's important, they're going to send it to me in another ways, and they're private companies that take over the slack. That said, just like public radio, there are reasons in more rural areas that if you don't have the government providing these services, mail, radio, internet, no one else, it's not economical for anyone else to do it. It's a real problem. It's a national service. You feel like you need to do that. So there are fights on both sides. I have heard that the requirements from the post office are quite onerous. I don't know enough about to tell you whether or not they put on something unreasonable there. I can tell you that living in an area where federal workers, you know, obviously Washington, D.C. has tens of thousands or millions of federal workers who, when the government, when Paul Ryan's budget gets adopted, which it won't in its current form, but people in this area lose jobs and lose income. And when you hear people like President Obama say, well, you know, we're going to freeze federal salaries for a couple years, and they do that as a bone to Republicans, somehow when they hurt federal employees, that people think that's a good thing. In my area, I do not see these fat bureaucrats working, you know, 9 to 4:30 wasting their time. Truly, I see people who are pouring their hearts into their jobs, who could be making more in the private sector, who work for the public good because they find it satisfying. Yes, part of it's because they have good benefits, but partly it's because they're public service-minded people. And to hear that they get their pay frozen because the country is unwilling to cut in other areas or tax certain people is something that I think is very frustrating to some folks in this area.
Mark, let's talk just briefly. I want to take one more call about the sequester. Are people feeling the effects of the sequester?
Yeah, you know, here's the perfect. I was at this is when you live in Washington, you know these people. I was at dinner with a friend's house recently where he's a civilian employee for the Department of the Navy. He's one of over 800,000 people who've gotten notices that he's going down to 4 days a week for at least the rest of this year.
Mm.
And I asked him, I said, whoa, that's, you know, that is that good or bad? His wife was standing between me and him. She looked at me with this horrified look saying, oh, it's terrible. He looked at me from behind her with both thumbs up, smiling, saying, this is great. Because basically he only has to work 4 days a week. So for some people, and they're comfortable enough that a 20% cut in one of their incomes, they're going to be able to survive it. It's not going to be easy. They've got kids going to college. They're going to suffer. But they're certainly not going to be, you know, suffering that badly. That's not true for other people. And absolutely, there are hundreds of thousands of people here whose incomes are going to go down.
Yeah, thanks. Let's get at least a comment from one more caller. We're running short on time. John in Madison. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to make a comment. With all the discussion about gun violence and gun control and gun safety, I just wanted to comment on the play on words in these three phrases. You hear gun violence, and that's violence and guns put together, which, you know, it's almost a statement by itself, which is an unproven statement. There is no direct causation between having guns and violence. And I don't know, just recently every time I hear gun safety, I think to myself, safety through more guns. I'd just like people to be aware of the play on words and how that can affect people's thinking when you hear these phrases day after day after day.
Yeah, how we use our words makes a difference, how the issue is framed, right, Mark?
When people say, I still don't understand, people say, well, a lot of the people who kill people have mental health issues. A lot of them? Tell me somebody who has murdered anybody, except in self-defense, who doesn't have mental issues, and they all have mental issues.
Mark, thank you very much for being with us. We covered a lot of territory. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Mark Sandelow, our guest, this All Things Political. He serves as the director of the California News Service and teaches University of California's Washington Center. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this program. Thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Great hour coming up.